This is Audible.
Listening Library presents What to Say Next by Julie Buxbaum. Read for you by Abigail Ravash and Kirby Hayborn.
For Josh, the president of my first tribe. So happy you let me keep my lifetime membership. I love you. And for Indy, Alili, and Luca. My heart, my reason, my home, my tribe, my life. The Book of Love is long and boring. No one can lift the damn thing. The Magnetic Fields.
Chapter 1. David. An unprecedented event. Kit Lowell just sat down next to me in the cafeteria. I always sit alone, and when I say always, I don't mean that in the exaggerated vernacular favored by my classmates. In the 622 days I've attended this high school, not a single person has ever sat beside me at lunch, which is what justifies my calling her sitting there, so close that her elbow almost grazes mine, an event. My first instinct is to reach for my notebook and look up her entry, under K for Kit, not under L for Lowell, because though I'm good with facts and scholarly pursuits, I'm terrible with names. Partly this is because names are random words completely devoid of context, and partly this is because I believe names rarely fit the people they belong to, which, if you think about it, makes perfect sense. Parents name their child at a time when they have the absolute least amount of information they will ever have about the person they are naming. The whole practice is illogical. Take Kit, for example, which is not actually her name. Her name is Catherine, but I have never heard anyone call her Catherine, even in elementary school. Kit doesn't in any way look like a kid, which is a name for someone who is boxy and stiff, and easily understandable with step-by-step instructions. Instead, the name of the girl sitting next to me should have a Z in it, because she's confusing and zigzagged and pops up in surprising places, like at my lunch table, and maybe the number 8, because she's hourglass-shaped, and the letter S, too, because it's my favorite. I like Kit because she's never been mean to me, which is not something I can say about the vast majority of my classmates. It's a shame her parents got her name all wrong. I'm a David, which also doesn't work because there are lots of Davids in the world, at last check 3,786,417 of them in the United States alone, and so by virtue of my first name, one would assume I'd be like lots of other people, or at the very least, relatively neurotypical, which is a scientific, less offensive way of saying normal. That hasn't been the case. At school, no one calls me anything, except the occasional homo or moron, neither of which is in any way accurate. My IQ is 168, and I'm attracted to girls, not boys. Also, homo is a pejorative term for a gay person, and even if my classmates are mistaken about my sexual orientation, they should know better than to use that word. At home, my mom calls me son, which I have no problem with because it's true. My dad calls me David, which feels like an itchy sweater with a too tight neck. And my sister calls me Little D, which for some inexplicable reason fits just right, even though I'm not even a little bit little. I'm 6'2" and 165 pounds. My sister is 5'3" and 105 pounds. I should call her Little L for Little Lauren, but I don't. I call her Miney, which is what I've been calling her since I was a baby because she's always felt like the only thing in a confusing world that belongs to me. Miney is away at college, and I miss her. She's my best friend, technically speaking my only friend, but I feel like even if I had friends, she'd still be my best one. So far, she's the only person I've ever known who has helped make being me a little less hard. By now, you've probably realized I'm different. It usually doesn't take people very long to figure that out. One doctor thought I might have a borderline case of Asperger's, which is stupid because you can't have a borderline case of Asperger's. Actually, you can't really have Asperger's at all anymore, because it was written out of the DSM-5, the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, in 2013. And instead, people with that group of characteristics are considered to have high-functioning autism, or HFA, which is also misleading. The autism spectrum is multidimensional, not linear. The doctor was obviously an idiot. Out of curiosity, I've done my own reading in this area. I bought a used DSM-4 on eBay. The 5 was too pricey. And though I lack the necessary medical training required to make a full diagnostic assessment, I don't believe the label applies to me. Yes, I can get myself into trouble in social situations. I like order and routine. When I'm interested in something, I can be hyper-focused to the exclusion of other activities, and fine, I am clumsy. But when I have to, I can make eye contact. I don't flinch if you touch me. I tend to recognize most idioms, though I keep a running list in my notebook, just in case. I like to think I'm empathetic, but I don't know if that's true. I'm not sure it really matters if I have Asperger's anyway, especially because it no longer exists. It's just another label. Take the word jock. If enough psychiatrists wanted to, they could add that to the DSM and diagnose all the guys on the Maple View football team. Characteristics would include at least two of the following. 1, athleticism, especially while wearing spandex. 2, unnatural ease with the concept of strapping a hard cup around your penis. 3, being an asshole. It doesn't matter whether you call me an aspie or a weirdo or even a moron. The fact remains that I very much wish I were more like everyone else. Not the jocks, necessarily. I don't want to be the kind of guy who gives kids like me a hard time. But if I got the chance to make some sort of cosmic upgrade, switch David 1.0 to a 2.0 version who understood what to say in day-to-day conversation, I'd do it in an instant. Maybe when parents name their children, they do it from the perspective of wishful thinking. Like when you go to a restaurant and ask for a rare steak, and even though there is no universally agreed definition of the word rare, you hope you get exactly what you want. My mom and dad ordered a David. They got me instead. In my notebook, Kit Lowell, height 5 feet 4 inches, weight approximately 125 pounds, wavy brown hair pulled into a ponytail on test days, rainy days, and most Mondays. Skin is brownish because her dad, a dentist, is white and her mom is Indian, Southeast Asian, not Native American. Class ranking, 14. Activities, school newspaper, Spanish club, pep club. Notable encounters. 1. Third grade. Stopped Justin Cho from giving me a wedgie. 2. Sixth grade. Made me a valentine. Note, KL made all the boys' valentines, not just me. But still, it was nice. Except for the glitter, because glitter is uncontainable and has sticky properties, and I generally don't like uncontainable and sticky things. 3. Eighth grade. After math class, she asked what I got on my math test. I said, 100. She said, wow, you must have studied hard. I said, no, quadratic equations are easy. She said, okay. Later, when I reenacted the conversation for Miney, she told me that I should have said that I had studied even if that meant lying. I'm not a very good liar. 4. 10th grade. Kit smiled at me when only our two names were announced as National Merit semifinalists on the loudspeaker. I was going to say congratulations, but Justin Cho said, "Damn, girl," first, and gave Kit a hug. And then she wasn't looking at me anymore. Important characteristics. 1. On cold days, she stretches her sleeves to cover her whole hands instead of wearing gloves. 2. Her hair isn't curly, but it isn't straight either. It hangs in repetitive alternating commas. 3. She's the prettiest girl in school. 4. She sits crisscross applesauce on almost all chairs, even narrow ones. 5. She has a faint scar next to her left eyebrow that looks almost like a Z. I once asked Miney if she thought I'd ever be able to touch that scar, because I'm curious what it feels like. And Miney said, "Sorry, little D, but as the magic eight ball says, my sources say no." 6. She drives a red Toyota Corolla. License plate, XHD893. Friends. Almost everyone, but mostly hangs out with Annie, Violet, and sometimes Dylan. The girl Dylan, not the boy Dylan. Common characteristics of friend group, with the exception of Kit, include flat-ironed hair, minor acne, and larger-than-average breasts. For 5 school days last year, Kit walked the halls holding hands with Gabriel, only occasionally stopping to make out, but now they don't do that anymore. I don't like Gabriel. Additional notes. Nice. Miney puts her on the trust list. I second. Of course, I don't open the notebook in front of her. Even I know better than that. But I do touch its spine, because having it nearby makes me feel less anxious. The notebook was Miney's idea. Back in middle school, after the locker room incident, which is irrelevant to this discussion, Miney decided I was too trusting. Apparently, unlike me, when most people talk, they aren't necessarily telling the truth. See, for example, the test lie suggested above. Why lie about whether I studied for a test? Ridiculous. Quadratic equations are easy. That's just a fact. "So your dad is dead," I say, because it's the first thing that pops into my head when she sits down. This is new information that I have not yet added to her notebook entry, only because I just found out. I'm usually the last to know things about my classmates, if I ever learn about them at all. But Annie and Violet were talking about Kit at Violet's locker this morning, which happens to be above mine. According to Annie, Kit's been, like, a total mess since the whole thing with her dad, and I know it's been hard and whatever, but she's kind of being, I don't know, mean. I don't usually listen to the other kids at school. Most of what they have to say is boring and feels like bad background music, something clanky and harsh, heavy metal, maybe. But for some reason, this seeped through. Then they started talking about the funeral. How it was weird that they cried more than Kit, that it's not healthy for her to keep things bottled up inside, which is a ridiculous thing to say because feelings don't have mass, and also, they are not doctors. I would have liked to go to Kit's dad's funeral, if only because he was also on my nice list, and I assume when someone on your nice list dies, you should go to their funeral. Kit's dad, Dr. Lowell, was my dentist, and he never complained about my noise-canceling headphones getting in the way of his drill. He always gave me a red lollipop after a cleaning, which seems counterintuitive, and yet was always appreciated. I look at Kit. She doesn't look messy. In fact, she seems better groomed than usual, and is wearing a man's white button-down shirt that looks recently ironed. Her cheeks are pink, and her eyes are a little wet. and I turn away because she is breathtakingly beautiful and therefore very hard to look at. I wish someone had told me, because I would have gone to his funeral. He used to give me lollipops, I say. Kit stares straight ahead, doesn't respond. I take this to mean I should keep talking. I don't believe in heaven. I'm with Richard Dawkins on that one. I think it's something people tell themselves to make the finality of death less scary. At the very least, it seems highly unlikely to me in the angels in white cloud iteration you hear about. Do you believe in heaven? I ask. Kit takes a bite of her sandwich, still doesn't turn her head. I doubt it, because you are a highly intelligent person. No offense or anything, but would you mind if we didn't talk? She asks. I'm pretty sure this is not a question she wants me to answer, but I do anyway. Miney has put the expression, no offense, on the be wary list. Apparently, bad things usually follow. I'd prefer it, actually. But I'd like to say just one last thing. Your dad shouldn't have died. That's really unfair. Kit nods, and the commas of her hair shake. Yep, she says. And then we eat the rest of our sandwiches, mine peanut butter and jelly since it's Monday, in silence. But good silence, I think.
Chapter 2. Kit. I don't really know why I decide not to sit with Annie and Violet at lunch. I can feel their eyes on me when I pass right by our usual table, which is at the front of the caf, the perfect table because you can see everyone from there. I always sit with them. Always. We are best friends, a three-person squad since middle school, and so I realize I'm making some sort of grand statement by not even waving hello. I just knew as soon as I came in and saw them huddled together, talking and laughing and just being so normal, like nothing had changed at all. And yes, I realized that nothing has changed for them, that their families are no more or less screwed up than they were before my life imploded, that I couldn't do it. Couldn't sit down, take out my turkey sandwich, and act like I was the same old reliable Kit. The one who would make a self-deprecating joke about my shirt, which I'm wearing in some weird tribute to my dad. A silly attempt to feel closer to him, even though it makes me feel like even more of an outcast and more confused about the whole thing than I was before I put it on. Just the kind of reminder I don't need. Like I could actually forget for even a single minute. I feel stupid. Could that be what grief does to you? It's like I'm walking around school with an astronaut's helmet on my head, a dome of dullness as impenetrable as glass. No one here understands what I'm going through. How could they? I don't even understand it. It seemed safer somehow to sit over here, in the back, away from my friends, who have clearly already moved on to other important things, like whether Violet's thighs look fat in her new high-waisted jeans. And away from all the other people who have stopped me in the hall over the past couple of weeks with that faux concerned look on their faces and said, Kit, I'm like so sorry about your dad. Everyone seems to draw out the word dad like they are scared to get beyond that one sentence, to experience the conversational freefall of what to say next that inevitably follows. My mom claims that it's not our job to make other people feel comfortable. This is about us, not them, she told me just before the funeral. But her way, which is to weep and to throw her arms around sympathetic strangers, is not mine. I have not yet figured out my way. Actually, I'm starting to realize there is no way. Certainly, I'm not going to cry, which seems too easy, too dismissive. I've cried over bad grades and being grounded and once, embarrassingly, over a bad haircut. In my defense, those bangs ended up taking 3 very long, awkward years to grow out. This? This is too big for woe-is-me, silly girl tears. This is too big for everything. Tears would be a privilege. I figure sitting next to David Drucker is my best bet, since he's so quiet you forget he's even there. He's weird. He sits with his sketchbook and draws elaborate pictures of fish, and when he does talk, he stares at your mouth, like you might have something in your teeth. Don't get me wrong. I feel awkward and uncomfortable most of the time, but I've learned how to fake it. David, on the other hand, seems to have completely opted out of even trying to act like everyone else. I've never seen him at a party or at a football game or even at one of the nerdy after-school activities he might enjoy, like math club or coding. For the record, I'm a huge fan of nerdy after-school activities, since they'll be good for my college applications, though I tend toward the more literary and therefore ever so slightly cooler variety. The truth is, I'm kind of a big nerd myself. Who knows? Maybe he's on to something by tuning the rest of us out. Not a bad high school survival strategy. Showing up every day and doing his homework and rocking those giant noise-canceling headphones and basically just waiting for high school to be over with. I may be a little awkward, sometimes a bit too desperate to be liked, but until everything with my dad, I've never been quiet. It feels strange to sit at a table with just one other person, for the noise of the calf to be something that I want to block out. This is the opposite of my own previous survival strategy, which was to jump headfirst into the fray. Oddly enough, David has an older sister, Lauren, who until she graduated last year was the most popular girl in school. His opposite in every way. President of her class and homecoming queen. Somehow she managed to make something that cliched seem cool again in her hipster, ironic way. Dated Peter Malvern, who every girl, including me, used to worship from afar because he played bass guitar and had the kind of facial hair that most guys our age are incapable of growing. Lauren Drucker is a living legend, smart and cool and beautiful, and if I could reincarnate as anyone else, just start this whole show over again and get to be someone different, I would choose to be her even though we've never actually met. No doubt she'd look awesome with bangs. I'm pretty sure that if it hadn't been for Lauren and the implicit threat that she would personally destroy anyone who made fun of her younger brother, David would have been eaten alive at Mapleview. Instead, he's been left alone. And I mean that literally. He is always alone. I hope I'm not rude when I tell him I don't feel like talking. Fortunately, he doesn't seem offended. He might be strange, but the world is shitty enough without people being shitty to each other. And he has a point about the whole heaven thing. Not that I have any desire to talk to David Drucker about what happened to my father. I can think of nothing I'd rather discuss less, except for maybe the size of Violet's thighs, because who cares about her freaking jeans? But I happen to agree. Heaven is like Santa Claus, a story to trick naive little kids. At the funeral, four different people had the nerve to tell me my father was in a better place, as if being buried 6 feet under is like taking a Caribbean vacation. Even worse were my dad's colleagues, who dared to say that he was too good for this world. Which, if you take even a second to think about, doesn't even make sense. Are only bad people allowed to live then? Is that why I'm still here? My dad was the best person I knew. But no, he wasn't too good for this world. He isn't in a better place. And I sure as hell don't believe everything happens for a reason. That this is God's plan. That it was just his time to go. Like he had an appointment that couldn't be missed. Nope, I'm not buying any of it. We all know the truth. My dad got screwed. Eventually, David slips his headphones on and takes out a large hardcover book that has the words Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 4 on the spine. We have almost all our classes together. We're both doing the junior year AP overload thing, so I know this isn't school reading. If he wants to spend his free time studying mental disorders, good for him. But I consider suggesting he get an iPad or something so no one else can see. Clearly, his survival strategy should include Mapleview's number one rule. Don't fly your freak flag too high here. Better to keep the freak buried, inconspicuous. Maybe under a metaphorical astronaut's helmet, if necessary. That may be the only way to get out alive. I spend the rest of lunch mindlessly chewing my sad sandwich. My phone beeps every once in a while with text messages from my friends, but I try not to look over to their table. Violet, did we do something to hurt your feelings? Why are you sitting over there? Annie, WTF! Exclamation, exclamation, question mark, exclamation, question mark, exclamation, question mark. Violet, at least write back. Tell us what's going on. Annie, K, Earth, 2K. Violet, just tell me the truth. Yay or nay on these jeans? When you have two best friends, someone is always mad at someone else. Today, by not texting back, I'm basically volunteering to be the one on the outs. I just don't know how to explain that I can't sit with them today. That sitting at their table, right there in the front of the cafe, and chatting about nonsense feels like a betrayal. I consider giving my verdict on Violet's pants, but my dad's dying has had the unfortunate side effect of taking away my filter. No need to tell her that though her thighs look fine, the high waist makes her look a little constipated. My mom said no when I begged her to let me stay home from school today. I didn't want to have to walk back into this cafeteria. Didn't want to go from class to class, steeling myself for yet another succession of uncomfortable conversations. The truth is, people have been genuinely nice. Even borderline sincere, which almost never happens in this place. It's not their fault that everything, high school, suddenly feels incredibly stupid and pointless. When I woke up this morning, I didn't have the blissful 30-second amnesia that has carried me through lately. That beautiful half minute when my mind is blank, empty, and untortured. Instead, I awoke feeling pure, full-throttled rage. It's been one whole month since the accident. 30 impossible days. To be fair, I'm aware my friends can't win. If they had mentioned this to me, if they had said something sympathetic like, Kit, I know it's been a month since your dad died, and so today must be especially hard for you, I still would have been annoyed because I probably would have fallen apart. And school is not where I want to be when that inevitably happens. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure Annie and Violet didn't mention it because they forgot altogether. They were all chatty, sipping their matching Starbucks lattes, talking about what guy they were hoping was going to ask them to junior prom. Assuming I just had a bad case of the Mondays. I was expected to chime in. I am somehow supposed to have bounced back. I am not supposed to be moping around in my dad's old shirt. 1 month ago today. So strange that David Drucker, of all people, was the only one who said the exact right thing. Your dad shouldn't have died. That's really unfair. You've been back 2 weeks already, my mom said over breakfast after I made one last plea to ditch. The band-aid has already been ripped off. But I don't have a single band-aid. I'd rather have two black eyes, broken bones, internal bleeding, visible scarring. Maybe to not be here at all. Instead, not a scratch on me. The worst kind of miracle. You're going to work? I asked. Because it seemed that if I was having trouble facing school, it should be hard for her to put back on her work clothes and heels and drive to the train. Of course, my mom was aware of the significance of the date. In the beginning, once we got home from the hospital, she was in constant tears, while I was the one who was dry-eyed and numb. For the first few days while she wept, I sat quietly with my knees drawn to my chest, my body racked with chills despite being bundled up in about a million layers. Still, a month later, I haven't managed to quite get warm. My mom, however, seems to be pulling herself back together into someone I recognize. You wouldn't know it from looking at her on the weekends when she wears yoga pants and sneakers and a ponytail, or from the way she looked right after the accident, shattered and gray and folded up. But in her working life, my mom is a hardcore boss lady. She's CEO of an online advertising agency called Disruptive Communications. Sometimes I overhear her yelling at her employees and using the kinds of words that would get me grounded. Occasionally, her picture is on the cover of trade magazines with headlines like, "The Diverse Future of Viral Media." She's the one who orchestrated that video with the singing dogs and cats that at last count had 16 million hits, and that Great Breakfast Cereal pop-up ad with the biracial gay dads. Before entering the throes of widowhood, she was pretty badass. "Of course I'm going to work. Why wouldn't I?" my mom asked, and with that she picked up my cereal bowl, even though I wasn't yet finished, and dropped it into the sink so hard that it shattered. She left, wearing her work uniform, a black cashmere sweater, a pencil skirt, and stilettos. I considered cleaning up the shards of glass in the sink, maybe even accidentally on purpose letting one cut me. Just a little. I was curious whether I'd even feel it. But then I realized that despite my new post-dad dying imbuing every single tiny thing with bigger meaning stage, like wearing this men's work shirt to school, that was just way too metaphorical, even for me. So I left the mess for my mom to clean up later.
Chapter 3. David. After lunch with Kit Lowell, I take off my headphones. Usually I keep them on between classes so that when I walk through the halls, the ambient noise is indistinct and muffled. That chatter and movement make me feel amped up and distracted and much more likely to trip. The shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and yet the boys in school dart from side to side full of random aggression. They jab their fists into each other's backs, tackle necks with smiles on their faces, high five hard. Why do they want to constantly touch each other? Though the girls don't weave as much as the guys, they also stop and start, often out of nowhere, hugging every so often even though they just saw each other before last period. I free-ear it because I am curious to hear if anyone is talking about Kit's dad. I googled his name and pulled up this obituary, which was in the Daily Courier, section A16, 3 weeks and 4 days ago. Only three short sentences, which, though I appreciate its succinctness, left out some relevant details, like the lollipops and the whole nice man part. Robert Lowell, DDS, passed away on Friday, January 15th, in a car accident. He was born on September 21st, 1971, in Princeton, New Jersey, and practiced dentistry in Mapleview for the past 12 years. He is survived by his wife, Mandeep, and their daughter, Catherine. Facts thus far learned from my quick search. 1. Kit's dad's name was Robert, which makes sense somehow. A familiar word and an even number of letters. I've always just thought of him as dentist, which now that I think about it is way too limiting. 2. Kit's dad died in a car accident, which is a misnomer because in the vast majority of car accidents where people end up dying, they don't actually die in the car, but afterward, in the ambulance or at the hospital. I'll have to find out the specifics. As I walk down the hall, I see Gabriel. Gabriel Forsyth. Curly hair. Marble eyes. Clown mouth. Notable encounters. 1. Seventh grade. Took my Oreos without asking. Snatched them from my insulated lunch bag and walked away. 2. Tenth grade. Held hands with Kit L. That's not an encounter with me, but it's still notable. 3. 11th grade. Sits next to me in physics because our seats were assigned by the teacher on day 1. When he saw how far he was from Justin Cho, he said, "Aw, shit, really, Mr. Schmidt?" for which he got a first warning. I did not point out that the seat was a relatively good one in terms of acoustics and board perspective. Miney said it was good that I kept that to myself. Friends. The lacrosse team, the tennis team, which of course has considerable overlap due to the seasonal schedules, best friends with Justin Cho since second grade, Additional notes. Miney puts him on the do not trust list. I do not look at him. Instead, I keep my head down, concentrate on keeping up with the stops and starts in front of me.
Yo, man, after practice, Pizza Palace, Gabriel says.
Based on the sneakers and the context, I'm 99% sure he is talking to Justin. I will not put Justin's notebook entry here, because I am tired of reading and rereading my notes about Justin and wondering why he hates me so much. An unsolvable equation. Our notable encounters list is 5 pages long. He is the president of the Do Not Trust Club. The Pizza Palace is the second best Italian restaurant in Mapleview, according to Yelp. Most people prefer Rocco's. If Gabriel were inviting me, which he is not, I would suggest we go to Pizza Pizza Pizza, which has 2 slices for the price of 1 from 2 to 5 p.m., and I believe the slight decrease in quality is more than made up for by the value. That said, I do get why they'd choose the Pizza Palace anyway, which is in no way a palace, just a small storefront on Main Street, because no matter how cheap the food is at Pizza Pizza Pizza, it feels funny to say the redundant name out loud. That's what I'm doing, imagining that Gabriel said, "Yo, man, after practice, Pizza Pizza Pizza," and thinking how that would have been ridiculous when I bump into a group of girls congregating around a locker. Jessica, Willow, who is notably the only Willow enrolled in our 397-student class and in our 1,579-student school, and Abby. Miney has labeled them in my notebook, in block letters and underlined with a Sharpie, the popular bitches. When she first used this designation, Miney had to give me a long lecture about how this wasn't an oxymoron, how someone could be both popular, which I presumed meant that lots of people liked you, and at the same time also be a bitch, which I presumed would have the opposite outcome. Apparently, popularity in the context of high school has a negative correlation with people actually liking you, but a high correlation with people wanting to be your friend. After careful consideration, this makes sense, though in my case, I am both an outlier and a great example of the fact that correlation does not imply causation. I am nice to everyone, but without any upside. People neither like me nor want to be my friend.
"Watch it,"
Jessica says and rolls her eyes, like I bumped into her on purpose. Haven't my classmates figured out that the feeling has become mutual? They want nothing to do with me? Fine. I want nothing to do with them either. Miney promises college will be better, though I highly doubt it.
And what's with all the talking to yourself?
Have I been talking to myself? It's entirely possible and somewhat ironic that my entire thought process about Pizza 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 and what a ridiculous name it is to say out loud actually occurred out loud. Occasionally, I forget about the barrier between the inside of my head and the rest of the world. "Sorry," I mutter to the floor and pick up the book she dropped and hand it to her. She doesn't say thank you.
"Freak,"
Abby says, and laughs, like that's funny or original. I force myself to meet her eyes, to look straight at her, because Miney claims eye contact humanizes me. Again, I have no idea why I need to be humanized in the first place, why everyone assumes I am some exception to the universally acknowledged rule that we are all human beings with feelings. Still, I do it anyway. Such is the power of Miney.
"What are you staring at?"
For a second, I consider asking Abby, straight out, just saying it out loud, "What have I ever done to you?" I bumped into Jessica, not her. We have had no notable encounters, positive or negative. But then the bell rings, and it's loud and uncomfortable, and everyone is rushing off to class, and I have physics, which means I now have to spend the next 45 minutes sitting next to Gabriel and trying to block out the fact that he smells like Axe Anarchy, for him, body spray, and taps his pencil against his desk to an erratic beat and clears his throat approximately every 35 seconds. No doubt, despite the acoustics and board perspective, I'd have been much better off sitting alone in the back. Kit slips into class 10 minutes into Mr. Schmidt's lecture on Newton's third law, which I've written down in Latin to keep it interesting. "Lost track of time," Kit says, and takes her seat, which is 2 behind me and 1 to the right. Not the greatest excuse, considering the school uses a loud bell to remind us to get to class. Mr. Schmidt nods and doesn't yell at her or give her a first warning like he normally would. Once, when we had to make a shiva call to our next-door neighbors, Miney told me that different rules apply to those who've just lost someone. I wonder how long that lasts. Not the dead part, of course, but the special treatment part. Would Mr. Schmidt make allowances for me if my dad died? Probably not. My dad is a medical researcher at Abbott Laboratories. I doubt he's on many people's nice list, mostly because he's not the type of person to make it onto any lists other than science ones. If my mother died, on the other hand, people would notice. She and Miney are similar that way. Everyone loves them. My mom is always stopping to talk to other women in the checkout line at the supermarket or at the drugstore. She knows the names of all the kids in my class and their parents, and sometimes she'll even add information to my notebook. She's the one who told me that Justin and Jessica were dating. She saw them making out at the mall, and then later that they broke up. This was gleaned somehow while getting her nails done, because she shares a chatty manicurist with Jessica's mom. Miney is the anti-me. She won numerous senior superlatives last year. Most popular, most attractive, most likely to succeed. I do not anticipate winning any. Though I guess Miney and I have one thing in common. Miney is also an example that correlation does not imply causation. She is popular, but not a bitch. Unfortunately, she has also led me to question the entire field of genetics, since we share 50% of our DNA. My parents have been married for 22 years, and they are still in love. This is statistically remarkable. My mom says, opposites attract. My dad says, I just got seriously lucky. Miney says, Mom is a closet weirdo, and Dad is a closet normal, and that's why they work. I haven't put much thought into their marriage, but I like that my parents are still together. I wouldn't want to have to pack a bag every other weekend and sleep in some strange apartment and have to brush my teeth in a different sink. My mom claims my dad and I are a lot alike, which gives me cause for optimism. If he could get someone like my mother to love him, someone who is universally acknowledged to be all kinds of awesome, and not just love him, but love him enough to spend the rest of her life with him, then maybe there is hope for me too. Halfway through class, when Mr. Schmidt starts writing equations on the smart board, Kit stands up and walks out. No explanation, no asking for a bathroom pass, no excuses. She just leaves. After the door closes behind her, the whispering starts. Justin, that was badass. Annie, she, like, needs to talk to us. She's totally shutting us out. Violet, her dad died, Annie, as in dead. Dead forever. Cut her some slack. Gabriel, I'm hungry. Annie, I have a power bar. Gabriel, you literally just saved my life. This is how it goes. Conversation swirls around me, and the words all feel disconnected, like playing pinball blindfolded. What does Kit's dad dying have to do with Gabriel being hungry?
Ladies and gentlemen, moving on,
Mr. Schmidt says, and then claps three times, clap, 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 for no discernible reason. Before I realize what I'm doing, my hand is in the air.
Yes, Mr. Drucker?
Can I be excused? I ask.
Excused? This is a classroom, not the dinner table. Let's get back to work.
I meant, can I go to the nurse? I have a migraine, I say, though this is a lie. Miney would be proud. She says I need to practice not telling the truth, that lying gets easier the more you do it. I consider making a moaning noise as if I am in pain, but decide that would be overkill.
Fine. Go, Mr. Schmidt says,
and so I stand up and walk out the door, just like Kit did a few moments before. It's not like I'm going to miss anything here. I read the textbook last summer. The few questions it raised for me were answered with a couple of Google searches and expounded upon by a free online Stanford class. Once I'm in the quiet hallway, my brain catches up with my body, and I understand what I'm doing here. Although Mr. Schmidt's class is boring and a complete waste of my time, I usually obey instructions. I sit through my classes, mostly keep my mouth shut. Unless I want to bypass high school and get a GED, I don't have much choice in the matter. What I realize is, I want to find Kit. I need to know where she's going. I jog down the hall and decide to head out the front door, ignoring Senora Rubinstein, the Spanish teacher, calling out to me in her heavy New Jersey accent,
"Adonde va, Senor Drucker?"
I scan the parking lot to my right, which is about 600 feet northeast of the school's entrance. No Kit. But her red Corolla, which is parked like always in the second row, six cars back, space number 43 of the upperclassmen's lot, is still here. I walk around the school to the football field, which has high bleachers and a decent view of Mapleview. Maybe she's sitting up there to get some fresh air. I don't like sporting events, too noisy and crowded, but I've always liked bleachers, things ordered vertically from high to low.
Did Mr. Schmidt send you?
Kit asks. She's not in the bleachers, which is where I was looking, but in the concession hut. This is where kids from student government sell hot dogs and lemonade and candy at football games at inflated prices. The lights are off, and she's sitting on the dirty floor with her knees pulled into her chest. If she hadn't spoken, I don't know if I would have noticed her.
No, I lied to him and said I had a migraine, I say, and forced myself to make eye contact. It's easier than usual, since it's dark in there.
Kit's cheeks are red from the cold. Her eyes are green. They've always been green, obviously, but today, they are greener, somehow. My new definition of green. Green used to equal Kermit the Frog, and sometimes spring, but no more. Now, Kit's eyes equal green. An inextricable link. Like how when I think about the number three, I always, for no reason that I've been able to understand, also see the letter R.
I wasn't trying to start a ditching trend, Kit says, and I smile, because if it's not exactly a joke, it is sort of related to one.
In case you hadn't noticed, I don't usually follow trends, I say, and point to my pants, which are loose-fitting and khaki-colored and, according to Miney, a crime against fashion. She's been begging to take me shopping for years, claims that I could look so much better if I put in just a tiny bit of effort. But I don't like shopping. Actually, it's not the shopping I mind so much. I don't like the new clothes afterward. The feeling of an unfamiliar material against my skin. Kit looks up at me, and then over my shoulder to the school.
So, are you following me? This isn't the nurse's office, she says. I can't make out her tone. Can't tell if she's annoyed. Her voice sounds scratchy and her face doesn't match any of the expression cards Miney once printed out for me.
I just wanted to make sure you were okay.
I hold up my hands, a signal to say no harm like they do on cop shows. Everyone was talking about me when I left, right? I didn't mean to make a whole thing about it, I just couldn't sit there suddenly, she says.
Clearly, I say. I mean that you couldn't sit there, not the making a whole thing about it.
Now that I'm here, talking to Kit twice in one day, when we haven't really spoken pretty much ever, except our few notable encounters, I realize how off schedule I find myself. None of this was part of today's plan. Me following her outside, me electing myself the one to check on her, me suddenly redefining green.
Chapter 4, Kit. I'm in the concession hut, and David Drucker is standing outside. The whole thing is so weird. Surely he knows that when I sat at his lunch table this afternoon, I was just looking for a place to be alone. I don't want anything from him, or for us to suddenly be besties or something. I don't mean that in a nasty way. I'm not usually like this. I don't abandon my friends in the cafeteria or walk out of class in the middle of the teacher's lecture or have any trouble lying and saying, "Your ass looks awesome in those high-waisted jeans." My dad's shirt is filthy. This place reeks of rotting hot dogs and old gym sneakers. Everything is wrong. It's been 1 month. I am still all wrong. I wasn't following you, David says, his eyes darting off the walls and then finally landing on mine. I mean, I was, but just because someone needed to follow you. Does that make sense? It's okay, I say, because he looks nervous and he makes me want to make things easier for him. Here, help me up. I don't want to touch the floor. David comes around to the side door. He puts out his hand, and I grab it and hike myself up to standing. This place is gross, I say. The bleachers would have been the better choice. You know what? That's a great idea. I sprint toward the field and then up the stairs, taking two at a time, and the momentum feels good, air pumped directly to my cold, dead heart. When I get to the top, I take a seat. I forgot how much I love being up here. I rarely miss a game, not because I care that much about football, but because I love being part of the crowd. Like there is nowhere else any of us is supposed to be except right here cheering on our team, perfect teenager cliches reporting for duty. I see David craning his neck to look up, probably deciding whether he should join me. Come on, I call to him. He takes the stairs more slowly than I did, stares at the ground so as not to fall. David is one of those random people at school you don't think about at all. But now that I've invited him to sit next to me here, I scramble to remember everything I know about him. That will hopefully make things slightly less uncomfortable because honestly, I'd totally pick the stomach flu over awkward. But the problem is, that's the first word I think of when I think of David. Awkward. I don't know much else about him. I remember I used to go to his birthday parties, and when he turned 5, he had one that was space-themed. We all got these cool NASA badges. I still have mine, actually. And his parents rented a bouncy castle that looked like the moon. We were jumping and then bumping into each other, and out of nowhere he fell to the floor and started crying with his hands over his ears. We all went home early. What else? I've seen him trip about a million times, and he has this bad habit of bumping into people. Maybe it's because he walks around with those huge headphones on and can't hear anything, or maybe it's because his mind is busy solving, like, global warming or something. And he's right. He's a terrible dresser. He looks like a missionary, or like he has an after-school job at an electronics store at the mall. Now that he's sitting up here, I quickly study his face, and I realize he's not bad-looking. actually a step up from Justin and Gabriel, who think they are hot shit despite their matching chin acne. If David got his hair cut and let people see his bottomless dark brown eyes, he'd be seriously cute. Probably the reason I invited him to sit next to me, if I'm honest with myself, is that my dad mentioned him out of the blue just a few months ago. At the dinner table one night, my dad announced that he thought I should get to know David Drucker. "David Drucker was in my chair today, and I gotta tell you, that boy is interesting. He talked to me about quantum mechanics," my father said. And I'm sure I replied with something sarcastic, like, "Sounds fascinating, Dad. I'll get right on that." Do I want to go back in time and punch myself in the face? Yes, yes, I do. The Arthur B. Penlock Stadium can hold up to 804 people, David says, sitting next to me now but looking out at the field. You can make out the post office from here, the cupcake bakery, Sam's Bagels. "That's what this place is called?" I ask. "The Arthur B. Penlock Stadium?" David nods. "I never knew that. I think I would have guessed more than 804 people. It gets pretty packed at the games." "I've never been," he says. "To a game? Really? They're fun," I say, though I wonder if our definitions of the word fun are the same. He shrugs. I consider asking him about quantum mechanics, but I don't even know what quantum mechanics is, or are. Is quantum mechanics plural? "Not a sports fan, I take it?" I ask somewhat inanely. I'm not sure why I've always assumed that the responsibility of a conversation falls on me. Half the time, I'm better off just shutting up. "Nope, I don't really understand the appeal. The suspense is inherently limited. Your team is either going to win or lose through some variation of throwing and catching balls. That said, I'd rather watch than play. Why would you let yourself be tackled to the ground and risk a potential head injury? It's confusing to me." "I can see how that would be confusing," I say, and find myself smiling. "I've considered whether some of the guys find it homoerotic, but most of them have girlfriends, so probably not." I laugh. "I'm only half joking," he says. He looks at me, and then his eyes dart away again. "We can stop talking if you want. I assume you left class to get away from all that noise, though my assumptions usually have only a 30% accuracy rate." "I did, actually," I say. "I can see the grocery store parking lot from up here, where my dad taught me to drive not so long ago. We went there at odd hours on weekends, and even some weeknights for the 3 months leading up to my birthday. He was patient with me, a good teacher, only getting annoyed in the beginning when I got confused between the gas and the brake. I passed my test on the first try, and my parents and I celebrated with sparkling apple cider and fancy champagne glasses. My dad toasted to all the roads Kit has yet to travel. He took a picture of me holding up my license, and then he teared up a little because he said he was already starting to imagine what it was going to be like when I left for college, how his life would have a Kit-shaped hole. My dad was supposed to miss me, not the other way around. That's how things were supposed to go. I don't want to think about that. After a while, quiet settles between David and me, and surprisingly, it's not awkward at all. It's actually kind of nice to sit up here, away from school and the shitstorm that awaits at home, away from the terrifying concept of one whole month. It's nice to sit with someone and not have to think about what to say next. I don't go back to class. Instead, I go home and spend my time lying on the couch and watching Netflix. Though I've been here for hours, I did not study for tomorrow's physics quiz. I did not read 50 pages of Heart of Darkness and think about its thematic relevance to my own life, though that should have been an easy one, or start that essay for World History on Migration. I also didn't write that article about the debate team for the school newspaper, even though the deadline is tomorrow by 3. We'll probably have to run a picture in its place. Clearly, this is not the way to make editor